More than 500,000 people in Illinois are taking care of family members who have dementia.
I set my mind to not get impatient. You really have to work at that. Like, be okay with, okay, this is the way it is. And if he's asked me a million times about whatever it is, what we're doing, whatever, you know, just, it's okay.
Today, we talk about what support exists for family caregivers in Illinois. Also, nutrition expert Marian Nessel says she knows that intentions for healthy eating are getting better.
Sugar intake in the United States in general is down. It's down quite a bit. And, you know, I think people are trying to eat more healthfully.
But one recent New York Times poll shows that nutritionists and everyday people have very different notions of what's healthy. We assemble a panel of nutrition experts from around the state to answer your questions about what's really good for you. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, there are more than 500,000 people in Illinois who are taking care of family members who have dementia. It can be time-consuming and emotionally draining job that many people do in addition to their regular work. Today, we're going to talk about what support networks exist for these caregivers. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by the Alzheimer's Association and a licensed professional counselor who works to manage their help care line, Peggy Rubenstein. But first, we wanted to speak with someone who spent the past 3 years taking care of her husband. Dorothy Rigg is in studio with me. She was just telling me about how she's been married to her husband, Ron, for 49 years. Dorothy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been a caregiver for your husband for almost 4 years now. When did you first realize that you needed to start taking on that role?
Back in 2012, he had the early stages of dementia. He was still able to drive. I was still working, or I had retired from my job and then went back to work part-time. And I worked another 3 years. But up until 2014, we had to take away his driving privileges.
Mm.
And like I said, he was still driving and stuff like that. But like some people, I think he got really confused and he was in another town, and he ended up going towards Indiana.
Wow. And where was he? So he was driving towards Indiana. Where was he supposed to be going?
Home.
He was supposed to be coming back here to Champaign.
Right. We have a place down at Lake Mattoon in Mattoon, mm-hmm. Illinois. And he would go down there when I was working. And he thought he was fooling me, but, you know, he tried to get back before I got off work, but I knew.
Okay.
I knew. And real quickly then, I seen he had a thing that he ate at Sonic in Mattoon. Well, you have to go all the way through Mattoon to get back out on the interstate.
Okay. So you realized right away that he
was... No, we think he made a turnoff someplace. So that's how he went through the country and ended up on 74 going east towards Indianapolis. But anyway, I had called him. I said, "Where are you at? You're not home." He said, "Oh, I'm over by Danville."
And he was on his way to Indianapolis.
Well, yeah, he didn't quite make that, you know.
Wow.
But that's what the lady, because we put a GPS on his telephone.
Mm.
And... I don't have a smartphone, so I had to call the jitterbug to, you know, to find
the phone
location.
Provider for them,
right,
to help. Mm-hmm.
Right, and I about lost it because she said, "I show him going east on 74 towards Indianapolis." It was scary.
Oh, I can't
because
imagine.
Then you think of all kinds of things. He could have been going on the interstate the wrong way.
Hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But he ran out of gas.
Okay.
So the state police had come and picked him up and took him back to the headquarters. So then my daughter and my son-in-law had to rent a trailer to go get him in the van.
Wow.
He was in the van, but he...
And that was sort of the beginning of the realization for you all and for your family that you...
More so, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I knew little things, you know. His mother had dementia. And she was in a nursing home for 4 years. And so I could see little things starting, you know. But then you I don't want to say deny it, but you just kind of put it on the back burner.
It's hard. It's hard to acknowledge, I'm sure.
You know, because he was still able to do other things. Mm-hmm. You know, he was still able to drive, which I know some of them can do, you know, and when you're in the early stages. So
that was 4 years ago. What's your life like now as a primary caregiver for your husband?
Our life has changed. When you're younger, you don't think that far ahead of things happening. You may think of, oh, my Lord, cancer or something like that. But nobody thinks about dementia or Alzheimer's. You really don't. I know my daughter had told my sister, she said, I thought Dad was going to get it, but not till he was older, you know. And like in his 80s or something.
And your husband's he's in his early 70s.
He's 75.
He's 75.
Yeah. I am his caregiver. But he also, I want to say this, that he goes to an adult daycare 4 days a week. And it's a circle of friends in Champaign. And it's been a godsend. Kathy and all of her staff have just been fantastic. And where he goes, it isn't just for people with dementia or Alzheimer's. It's an adult daycare, and they do a lot of activities.
So it sounds like it's great for both of you.
Right. It's good for me, too, because I get the break, you know. I'm like most caregivers that will say, I know that's what they say, well, I'm going to take care of him, I all the time. But there's a point in time where you can't take care of him 24/7. And the daycare allows me to have him at home, which is where I want him to be.
Have both of you living at home together, as opposed to having him in an assisted living facility or some other facilities.
Exactly.
And it gives you that time and that flexibility as well, sounds like.
Right.
That's Dorothy Riggs. She's in studio with me. We're talking about particularly families who are providing caregiving from family members and loved ones who have dementia. I want to bring someone else into this conversation who's joining us on the line from Chicago, from the Greater Illinois Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Peggy Rubenstein is the manager of the Helpline and Care Navigation for the association. She's also a licensed professional counselor. Peggy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. How typical is Dorothy's story as she's sharing this?
Mm-hmm. In some ways it's typical, but I think it's important to remember that everybody's experience is different and unique with the disease. I mean, there's some similarities, and then there's also some differences. Everyone's course with Alzheimer's or any type of dementia is oftentimes unique depending on, you know, how they're experiencing the disease and how it's progressing. I do want to commend Dorothy as a caregiver that she is taking care of herself and is able to, do the adult day center. It's a godsend for people.
True. Very true.
What do you think are the biggest challenges, Peggy, for families who are taking on caregiving roles? Does it tend to be logistical in terms of trying to organize all these resources? Is it emotional? Is it different for everyone, as you're saying?
Mm-hmm. It's a 24/7 job. It's a 24/7 job. I mean, Dorothy can get a few hours, you know, here and there to do what she needs to do and do some self-care and, do some household things. But it is a 24/7 job, and it does take more than one person doing it. So I would recommend that people try to get a support team in place as early as possible in the disease, because you're going to need it.
And when you say a support team, who should be a part of that support team, Peggy?
Friends, family, neighbors. Anytime somebody asks you, we recommend to caregivers to make a list of five things that you would like help with, because sometimes family or friends will say, oh, well, let me know if there's anything I can do. And then you can pull out your list and say, well, as a matter of fact, could you come over and have lunch with my wife or my husband today or next week? Or can you take me to the store or whatever that may be? I think being really specific with people is going to help you, and also it helps them to know what they can do.
And where do you also recommend, Peggy? Well, as you're talking about that five things, Dorothy, do you feel like you have a support network that you have established over the years? It sounds like your family, your children are a big part of that.
Our daughter and our son-in-law, and then I have a sister and brother-in-law that don't live very far from me. So, you know, if I would need them, they'd be there in a heartbeat.
I imagine your social life, Dorothy, has really changed because of your husband's dementia. Did you find that your social circle and your life sort of changed as his after he was first diagnosed, and as you've taken on more of a role of caregiving?
Everything was pretty well going along really good the first couple 3 years or something like that, and then it's as he's progressively gotten a little worse. With his memory and doing things, we don't go out as much socially. We don't see our friends, and we really should. And I do want to say something, and probably Peggy will agree with this. It's sometimes difficult for the friends. They don't understand, and they'll say, well, I'd like to come by and see Ron, but I don't know what to say to him. And I say, you don't have to say anything. Just come and visit. Talk a little bit. I said, he'll talk to you, but he'll go off on something that doesn't make any sense. But if you don't come by, he won't remember you after a while. And that's what's hard. Ron doesn't realize it. It's hard on me.
Peggy, what advice do you have for Dorothy? As she's sharing that, I imagine there are a lot of families who are in that situation. There are probably a lot of people listening who have friends or former colleagues or people. What other advice can you offer for people?
Well, I absolutely agree. It is incredibly hard. Sometimes people do step away because they're not sure what, like Dorothy said, they're not sure what to say. They're scared themselves because they don't understand the disease. It's something that scares them, the thought of getting that. But, you know, if they can't do it for their friend who has Alzheimer's, they need to do it for the caregiver and for Dorothy because Ron might not remember, but Dorothy sure does.
Yes.
And they can do it in honor, you know, of Dorothy and her family to come by and see Ron. And I think once people do that, once they start connecting with people that have dementia, they'll realize, oh, okay, this is not that scary.
Yeah.
And Ron will have moments of clarity, and he will recognize the care and concern. And then people will get comfortable talking to him and talking to other people with dementia. You do get used to it, and there is meaning in it.
Peggy, I wanted to ask you about what resources are available for people for supporting caregivers. You're with the Alzheimer's Association for Greater Illinois. I know that there are lots of resources available for people by county. Is that the best way for people to think about resources?
Well, I think the best way for them to think about resources is our helpline, our 24/7 helpline that I believe you're going to put on your website and tweet it out. It's 800-272-3900, and that's a 24/7 number. So if people are looking for example, care navigation, that's a service that we offer. Well, we can do either by phone or if you're near our Rockford office, our Joliet office, our Chicago office, we can meet you in person. And if not, we can do it by phone where we can help you with some long-term care planning, kind of give you a heads up of what you're looking at in the future and discuss a care plan moving forward.
And Peggy, are those services available for free for people?
They are. They are. Yeah. And that's what the licensed counselor like myself or a social worker. The meetings are about 90 minutes, and families find them extremely beneficial. So the earlier the better that you can get in touch with the Alzheimer's Association. We do have early stage support groups. We have regular caregiver support groups. We have a series called Joyful Living, and that's for folks and their caregivers in the early stages of Alzheimer's to do it. We do events. We've been to the Art Institute a few times. We do nature walks. We have an early stage phone support group around the greater Illinois area. And we also, like I said, we do, we have caregiver support groups also. And then we have education. We have webinars. If folks can't get out, we can do it on the computer. There are education programs by phone.
So it sounds like there's
lots of
resources
lots of
available. Mm-hmm. We're gonna take a break, but when we come back, we're gonna continue this conversation with Peggy Rubenstein from the Alzheimer's Association, the Greater Illinois Chapter, and Dorothy Rigg, talking about family caregiving for loved ones with dementia. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about families who are caring for loved ones with dementia. My guests are from the Alzheimer's Association of Illinois, Peggy Rubenstein. She's the manager of the Helpline and Care Navigation. In studio with me, here in Champaign, Dorothy Rigg has been sharing her story about caregiving for her husband, who is 75 years old. Dorothy, I wonder what's made the biggest difference for you in this 4-year journey that you've been on. It sounds like having your husband enrolled in the Circle of Friends adult daycare has made a huge difference for you. What else has been an important thing for you as you've been living with this?
Okay. There's a lot of different things that go on with people with dementia or Alzheimer's. It's not just the memory part of it. That's the big part of it. But I have found with Ron that he has trouble sitting, you know, in the chair.
Knowing when the chair is there.
Mm-hmm. And then once he's sitting, sometimes it's hard to get up. So I did get a lift chair, which has been the best investment I've ever made. I got it through a friend on Facebook that I knew that it was her husband's, and he was in a nursing home, so she didn't need the chair anymore. But anyway, it's been a godsend because there was times of getting him ready to go to bed at night. He would resist my help, and anyway, couldn't get him. And then I'd go off by myself because you don't want to yell at them. Try not to yell at them and that because they don't understand. But then I would say, please, God, I don't know whether I can do this anymore. You know. But
Dorothy, thank you for sharing your story. I really appreciate it. Peggy, as we're thinking about families, and thank you for all the resources that you have listed for us. There's a lot of them. I wonder if you could say that helpline number one more time, and I can remind everybody that we've tweeted out the link to all of the resources for the Alzheimer's Association, and they'll be on our website, which is www.24show.org. And Peggy, can you remind us of the helpline number again, which is the 24/7 helpline available for folks?
Sure. It's 800-272-3900.
And when people are in situations where they need to make difficult decisions about moving family into assisted living facilities or bringing in outside care. What kind of resources is the Alzheimer's Association? Is that something that you all can kind of help guide people with as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can definitely help guide them. That's the nice thing about the helpline. The beauty of it is that when you call, you know, it's about we respond to your individual situation. So we get so many different types of calls and questions. And sometimes people just want to talk about it before they're ready to make a decision. They want to ask, you know, when is it a good time? How will I know my loved one is ready? So we can talk about it with you and also send you some materials that may be helpful in making those decisions.
And as you're talking about care groups that are available, are those things that you said, it sounds like there are phone groups as well as maybe in-person groups throughout the state for caregivers to be able to have support networks with other caregivers?
Mm-hmm. Well, for the early stage, we have phone support groups. So that's for folks in the early stages of the disease that understand that they have Alzheimer's or another type of dementia, and they would like to talk to other people that have the disease. So we do a phone group once a month, and people find that very beneficial. So for caregiver groups, those are in-person groups. We do have some online groups also. People can go online and look at the online group.
And before we wrap up this conversation, let's end it with a caller. George, welcome to the 21st. You're calling from Champaign. What's your comment?
We went through this with my mom before she passed away, and some of my siblings were a little bit hesitant to get help. And you know what? When we finally did, here's what I realized. So important to get professional help, 24/7 if you can get it, because professional help will take care of all those details so that the family members can focus on the love. And that's the most important part, ultimately, is to not get frustrated so that you are there for your loved one in this very difficult time.
George, thanks for that. Thank you so much for that comment. I want to thank Dorothy Rigg for coming in and for sharing her story, and also thank Peggy Rubenstein from the Alzheimer's Association. As I said, all of those resources are available on our website at 21stshow.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dorothy.
Thank you, Peggy.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With all the news headlines about what's good for you to eat and what's not, it's no wonder that people can be confused about what is healthy food. A recent poll conducted by the New York Times found some major differences between what nutritionists consider to be healthy food and what the general public believes. It turns out the only thing we can agree on, things that aren't healthy, are obvious ones. Think chocolate chip cookies, french fries, and bacon. But there's lots of confusion about sushi, cheese, even popcorn. So what's healthy? How much fat and protein should you be eating? And the dreaded sugar question. We thought we'd convene a panel of nutrition experts from all across Illinois to talk about these things and to answer your questions about healthy eating. Do you have questions about the right balance of protein, fat, and sugar? What other questions about healthy eating do you have for our panel? You can give us a call. Our phone number, as always, is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions to 21st Show. That's 21st Show. We've got questions compiled from Facebook and Reddit that we're going to get to with our panel of three nutritionists. Josh Klazinski is a clinical nutrition manager at St. John's Hospital in Springfield. Linda Van Horn is a professor of preventative medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. And joining us from Normal, Jennifer Barnes is an assistant professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Sciences at Illinois State University. Josh, Linda, Jen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
So let's start with this first. I want to start with just asking you all, as nutritionists and people who are in this industry, if you were surprised. Josh, let's start with you. with these survey results from the New York Times. And I think everyone agrees on fruits and vegetables and things like cookies, but the middle is where there's a lot of confusion. And actually, one of the things we were most surprised about was granola bars, because 70% of Americans think that granola bars are healthy, but less than 30% of nutritionists agreed. Josh, were you surprised by these survey results?
You know, I really wasn't. I really think that when the average consumer picks up a box of granola bars and sees things like low fat or high in whole grains, those kinds of food health claims, they think that it's a healthy product. Well, if you actually flip over the box and check out the nutrition facts label, sugar is usually really high on the ingredients list. So I think it's very misleading and the perception's a little bit off for the average consumer who doesn't look into the situation very deeply.
Well, and Linda, obviously you are very familiar with consumer guidelines on health because you helped chair the group that reviewed the 2010 U.S. dietary guidelines, and those come out every 5 years. When nutritionists are coming up with the guidelines, how are they hoping people will be reading them? How do you think people should look at these guidelines?
Right. Well, you know, the good news is that the guidelines are evidence-based, so the committee is charged with literally reviewing the world's literature over the past 5 years on diet and health. So the decisions that are made and the opinions that are expressed are related to data that associate the food with outcomes, meaning health. And so the guidelines are predicated on that, and therefore, you know, the recommendations that are made are always focusing on what is known to be associated with health and long life. So the translation part is what gets so confusing, because all grains are not created equally. And as was just pointed out, in terms of something like granola, which a lot of people think, forget the bars, even granola itself is not necessarily healthy, given the fact that it can contain a lot of sugar, a lot of fat, a lot of calories that people are totally unaware of as far as putting something healthy in their mouths.
Jen, what's your philosophy of looking at guidelines and nutrition? How do you think people should be thinking about this?
I think we need to appreciate that the experts take care of a lot of the hard work for us, like Linda just said, and they are translated for the public. It's knowing where to go and where to look and knowing what's a reliable source. That part's very, very important. A lot of the popular press can be biased, it can be swayed, and that helps to sensationalize some of the research that's coming out. But the guidelines are very, very broadly reviewed and really try to represent what we know to be true from scientific evidence in a way that the public can understand.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. You can call, you can tweet to 21st Show if you have a question to pose to our panel about nutrition and food. Let's go to Mike in Decatur. Hey, Mike, welcome to the 21st. Do you have a question about protein?
I do. I was wondering how much protein a person could, well, in my case, a full-size 230-pound man could assimilate after a vigorous workout. A typical protein shake or a serving I try to eat after a workout is in the 30 to 40 gram range, and I'm wondering if a person, if I can assimilate all that after workout, or some of that's just wasted.
Jen, I know you handle a lot of sports nutrition. Do you want to tackle that?
I would love to address that question. 30 to 40 grams post-workout is going to be plenty as far as what your body needs in order to start to stop that muscle catabolism or muscle breakdown and start to rebuild and build new muscle, in fact, in response to the stimulus that you just gave your body. So that's great that you go for that protein afterwards. As far as whether or not your body can handle it, our digestion and absorption is quite robust. So as long as you don't notice any acute upset, then I think you're doing just fine.
Thanks for that, Jen. Let me ask you, Josh, I wanted to ask you if let's do, there's lots of different foods I think people are confused by. So I thought we could do with some. One of the things that we asked people on Reddit to chime in what foods people think are healthy, but really aren't. And one user responded, granola, instant oatmeal, breakfast cereal. Josh, let's talk about breakfast foods, because I think there are a lot of common breakfast foods that people aren't thinking about sugar and nutrition necessarily for breakfast. Can you weigh in on that?
Sure. I think sugar is the kind of key phrase we usually think of when we talk about breakfast foods and sweets. So kind of like the article we were referencing, there are so many things that are just jam-packed with sugar. So take yogurt, for example. Yogurt, in my opinion, is a very wholesome type food when it's, you know, unsweetened. But to get that fruit flavoring or to get the vanilla flavor, you have to add tons of sugar, which makes it equivalent to having a bowl of ice cream for breakfast, which I am not by any means recommending in the air. So I really think that it's a lot of hidden sugar, similar to, you know, pancakes, sweetened cereals, the same difference. It's all going to have lots of added sugar.
Well, Josh, you know, you mentioned yogurt, and Linda, I wanted to ask you about this, because when we were started planning this segment, all of the producers, we were all sort of laughing about the Seinfeld episode where they get into this frozen yogurt kick because they think it's really healthy. And this is actually, you know, Seinfeld was a really long time ago, but even as you look at studies, people think, oh, it's fat-free or it's made with fruit. And then, of course, they all gain weight, and it's sort of this joke of the episode. But Linda, do you think a lot of this has to do with marketing, of people just sort of getting obsessed with things, saying like, oh, this is low fat, or thinking this has fruit, so it must be good for me?
Yeah, and I think actually, you know, television puts the finger on the pulse of the public as far as what's currently going on. So I think that did a great job of putting the point across. And I think what was just mentioned about, you know, sugar laden foods that take a perfectly healthy food like yogurt can be, and then further deteriorate, you know, the nutritional value of it by adding all those extra calories. I think the same thing can be said about smoothies. You know, in general, those are viewed as a very healthy thing to consume until you stop and look at the number of calories, which can be over 600 calories, and most of that comes from sugar as
well.
Wow,
600 calories in a smoothie.
Exactly.
Well, and I want to ask all of you, I mean, Linda, the one thing that I found very helpful is now, especially when you're eating out, having calorie counts on menus. Do you think that that's going to really start changing people's behavior, because they can see, like, for example, at McDonald's, they have the calories, so you can kind of just look at everything when you're there. Do you think that makes a difference?
Well, I think, again, during the time of the 2010 guidelines, which was the first report that actually addressed the American public as being unhealthy, every other set of guidelines worked with what is typically considered the healthy American public. And because the majority of our population is now overweight or obese, the intent of those guidelines and everything subsequently has been to try to get America to focus on the fact that obesity is not a good thing, and that we in fact recognize that eating too many calories is what is contributing to our obesity problem. So the time it will take for the majority to become more and more familiar with those calorie counts may take a while. But for those who are already interested, that is a tool that can be used in helping to make informed choices about the foods that people eat.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about food and nutrition with our panel, who's joining us from all across Illinois. You can join us as well with questions. If you have questions about fat, what's healthy, what isn't, we've got some more on Facebook that we're going to get into. But our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking nutrition. We're talking about what's healthy, what isn't when it comes to food. We've been talking about breakfast foods and yogurt and frozen yogurt. It turns out the New York Times did a great survey about this. We've tweeted out the link if you want to see it at 21ST Show. But there's a big gap between what nutritionists think is healthy and what the general public does. So we've got a panel of nutritionists here to help enlighten all of us. They're joining us from all different parts of the state. From Springfield, Josh Klesinski is the clinical nutrition manager at St. John's Hospital in Chicago at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. We have Linda Van Horn, who teaches preventative medicine. And we have Jen Barnes on the line with us from Normal in Illinois State University, where she's in the Department of Family and Consumer Sciences. Jen, I wanted to ask you, we got a question on Facebook from Steph, who says she wants to know about sushi. And sushi is one of those foods, it's actually one of the most Googled, is sushi healthy, which we also learned from this New York Times story. But half of Americans think sushi is healthy. 80% of nutritionists think this is healthy. This is our Facebook question from Steph. I can see how sushi can be good, considering the lean protein of fish and some particularly fatty fish being a rich source of omega-3. But what about the glycemic index of short-grain sushi rice? How much is good and how much becomes too much of a good thing? Jen?
That's an interesting question. I think sushi is one of those foods that on the surface looks very, very healthy. And she made some very good points there about the lean protein and the omega-3 fatty acids. But we can get in trouble with sushi. We like to put cream cheese in it. We like to put fried shrimp in it.
I was going to say fried tempura batter.
Exactly, right. Yes. So in the broad picture as far as sushi goes, we tend to, you know, maybe not overeat on sushi that much. Maybe that's incorrect if you start to get a lot of different rolls and everything. But I would worry less about the glycemic index of white rice and just think more about how much you're eating total. You need carbohydrates in your diet. Certainly a whole grain would be better than a white rice. But as long as you're not over-consuming, then I don't think the glycemic index is something to get too stressed out about.
Linda, I wanted to ask you about that middle category, which lots of people seem to be confused about, which is like butter, red meat, whole milk, and cheese. And it seems like this is an area where nutritionists and the general public sometimes can have differing opinions with whether or not these things are healthy for us. And Linda, what balance do you think there should be between protein and fat?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and frankly, one that is changing as data become available and science produces new answers. While I think that at least based on current evidence, there's no question that a diet excessive in red meat and especially in processed meats, we're talking deli meats, sausages, hot dogs, things of that sort, there's no question that the evidence shows that there is an adverse impact on our health, ranging from cardiovascular disease to even certain types of cancer. So excessive intakes of those kinds of foods are definitely problematic and should be limited. When it gets to dairy, however, it's an interesting story that seems to be still somewhat open for consideration. We all recognize dairy offers amazing nutrients in terms of our needs, like calcium and vitamin D, for example, which tend to be low in this country. And because of the saturated fat in whole fat, buttermilk or butter content of milk and cheese, et cetera, it's been recommended that those foods be limited. And it still is. On the other hand, as we begin to go forward in differentiating fats and carbohydrates, they're not all created equally. So there's a difference between meat fat, for example, and dairy fat. And we're only now really being able to tease that out, given some of the modern technology.
Yeah, what do we think? I mean, what's dairy fat? Because I've seen lots of studies about how full-fat dairy makes you feel fuller, and so that's a helpful thing, too, in terms of eating less. Where's the research at on that right now, Linda?
Well, the epidemiologic evidence shows that, again, compared to something like meat, the saturated fat in dairy appears to be less harmful, but no one is going over the edge yet and saying, you know, oh, yes, eat up on butter and whole milk. That's
no one's saying
not
eat too much cheese, because that would be great. No,
right.
No one's saying that. Okay.
I think everyone would like that. But
okay.
just like we recognize, as was discussed earlier, that carbohydrates can range in everything from oatmeal to sugar. Sugar is a carbohydrate. And so there's confusion about, you know, carbs, for example, just like there is about fats, because they're not all the same. So science is an evolving process. And, you know, I think everyone should just be aware that as we learn more and discover more, some of these kinds of recommendations will change.
And
but
I do, yeah.
Processed meat is definitely not a good thing.
Right. And I want to get to the fat question. And Josh, I'm going to ask you that in a second about good fats. But we've got a caller. Again, our number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Ed in Springfield. We were just talking about dairy. Ed, you have a question about butter and milk?
Well, I have a question about the so-called lactose intolerance that seems to be everywhere. And I've been affected by, I'll just say, gas upon milk product ingestion, say, over the last 20 years, I've noticed. After a prior lifetime of enjoying milk without a problem. And I've noticed, as I try very hard to find a milk product that doesn't give me gas, that even if I try lactose-free products, I'll still get this gas. And I stumbled into an article, a woman on TED Talk, talking about a GMO protein that was used to manufacture a growth hormone that's now widely used in the dairy industry, almost exclusively in America. And I was wondering if
Ed, hold on a second. Can you hold on a second and let's ask Josh, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, and I forgot to ask, Ed, hold on. Ed, how old are you?
50.
Okay, thanks for that. Josh, I wonder if you can help Ed with that in terms of, as he's thinking about maybe becoming more lactose intolerant. That's probably a pretty common thing you hear at St. John's.
Sure, we do see patients that come through here that develop a lactose intolerance later in life. Basically, they have simple remedies. They just kind of stay clear of lactose. They do some substitutions with some almond-type milks or soy milks. As far as the GMO part, I really can't speak to that. I don't know if anyone else on the call is able to address that question.
Jen, do you want to, or Linda, do either of you want to weigh in? Okay, so I think, go ahead. Who was that?
This is Linda. All I can say is that I'm aware that the dairy industry and farming has, you know, gone in that direction, but I don't believe we have data at this point specifically to that question and whether that is interrupting the lactose-lactase cycle. I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. Again, our number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Scott on Twitter had a question. If the panel could recommend sources for reliable nutrition and education. Jen, let's start with you. What's your favorite go-to sources for reliable nutrition and education?
That's an excellent question. And I think we sort of skirted the edge of it earlier, Linda especially. MyPlate.gov is an excellent resource for people who are interested in learning how to construct their meals on a day-to-day basis. It really gives you some good visuals for doing that. And the Dietary Guidelines for Americans does a good job of summarizing where we have deficits as a population and what we really need to work on. So those, I would say, are the first two lines of information for anyone in the public who's looking to find some big picture ways to improve their diet.
Josh, I wonder if there are other sources that you would recommend as well?
Sure. I would not disagree with the recommendations we just heard for USDA, for the guidelines and the MyPlate. Those are excellent sources. After that, if there's something more specific you're looking for, something like for diabetes or for cardiovascular health, you could always turn to the national representative, so the American Diabetes Association, or I think heart.org is the cardiovascular website. They have excellent things like recipes you can try and just general advice as well.
Linda, can I ask a question? Do you sort of ignore all of the media headlines that seem like every day? In fact, right before the show, we were looking at the British newspaper, The Independent, had a headline, "Stop eating sausages. They're really bad for you," which probably is not a surprise. But do you just sort of not pay attention to all of the different, how do you recommend people handle that?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, and I do have to confront it because we do research with real-life people. And so I need to be able to know what it is they're seeing, they're reading, and they're understanding. And my advice generally to our participants in our research projects, because these questions come up all the time, is look at the source. I think we haven't talked about coconut oil, for example, but, you know, my
That was one that was a very different, that its survey showed people have very differing, nutritionists and the general public have very different opinions on.
Well, in my opinion, it's an example of marketing. Hats off to the coconut industry. I don't know who is behind
them. Because now you can get coconut oil everywhere.
Job
right.
Of convincing people that this is just the wonder product of all time. And, of course, it's not. Coconut oil is 98% saturated fat. So, you know, put it on your skin, but don't put it in your mouth. And I think, you know, those kinds of advertisements, which really sound like edutainment almost. You know, it's interesting and people literally buy into it because marketing and advertising is amazingly effective. So our advice is, you know, look at the source. If it's coming from your local friendly food industry, then you know, you're getting sold the product, not necessarily the education behind it.
Josh, I wanted to ask you, we were going to talk about fat, and I wonder if, as Linda's comments remind me that to just ask you a quick question and a reminder of what the quote-unquote good fats are that we should be thinking about.
Not coconut milk or oil.
Right.
So I would say things like the unsaturated fat sources. So if you get fats from items like avocados or the omega-3s that you find in fish products, those are the items that are going to give you the most bang for your buck as far as fat intake goes. And I think that I just want to highlight the fact that not all fats are created equal. I know we talked about this with carbohydrates earlier. It's kind of one of the same guidelines.
Let me, we just have a couple minutes left here, so let me just ask all of you of the panel if you could all weigh in. Let's start with this. Jen, let's start with you. What's the one healthy food you recommend everyone incorporate into their diet somehow? Jen?
Oh, I really dislike that.
You don't like that question? Okay. You can say you don't want to answer it also.
It's not because I don't think I think there are way too many excellent foods to incorporate, and the idea of the superfood, I think, is just one more of those marketing things where that's how we get on fads like coconut oil and things of that nature. So I'm just going to go very broad and say eat more fruits and vegetables.
Okay. Linda, what's your response?
Well, I think that was a very appropriate answer. But what I'd like to point out is the unsung hero in our diet that people ignore completely is fiber, dietary fiber. And we were talking earlier about breakfast. If you skip that opportunity for a whole grain or a high-fiber cereal without the sugar and fat, you pretty much have lost the day because there are so few other places where you can really find foods that meet those needs. And if our country could flip the scale around and eat 28 to 30 grams of dietary fiber every day, the foods that provide that fiber are going to put them in a much healthier position than we are now.
Thanks for that, Linda. Josh, I'll let you have the last word as to final bits of advice or the healthy food you want to offer for people.
You guys took all the good foods. So I'm going to go with lean proteins then, since we didn't touch on that one yet. I would say focusing on foods that are unprocessed, natural, and trying to get more vegetarian sources of protein, like legumes, rice, ancient grains that have higher protein content, that sort of.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. So Josh Klasinski joining us from St. John's Hospital in Springfield, where he's a clinical nutrition manager. I want to thank Linda Van Horn in Chicago, where she teaches at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, and Jen Barnes from Illinois State University, where she teaches in Normal. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All of the resources that we mentioned are on our website at www.21stshow.org. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the challenges of placing LGBT children in foster care. We're going to be speaking with the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services and a foster dad of four sons. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.